Welcome back to the High Tech Forum podcast. I'm your host, Richard Bennett. Today, I'm joined by Shane Tews, who's going to interview me, actually, on some questions regarding current events in the world of network policy. So, hi, Shane.
Hi, Richard. I like to think these as the explain to Shane. I come up with lots of questions, and you're my answer man.
Well, these are always good discussions. I look forward to them.
Well, to Richard, it's been a really interesting week. I think we've gone from a dozen people knowing what 5G is to maybe a couple thousand.
But do they really know what it means?
No, they don't. They don't. They just know that somebody dropped a PowerPoint apparently behind the White House coming out of the National Security Agency and thought that maybe they should nationalize 5G. So let's just start with, you would just want to tell the kids out there, what is 5G?
Well, let me talk about the PowerPoint a little bit first, and then I'll get into that.
Yes.
To me, the PowerPoint, I mean, when I read the story in Axios, and especially when I looked at the PowerPoint, I thought, gee, am I reading InfoWars? You know, because this is like, we have an anonymous source in the White House who has told us about this secret plan to take over the nation's communication networks. I mean, this is radical. This is extremely radical. And to suggest that the Trump White House is all, you know, locked arms about where we're going to move in and take over, the nation's mobile communication networks, it's an extraordinary claim. And the evidence to support it was somewhat underwhelming, to say the least. I mean, it wasn't even clear to me that the person who wrote that PowerPoint knew what the words meant, because they use some of the technical terms like incorrectly. And it seemed like kind of junior staffer stuff, or maybe somebody deliberately concocted it, like that the sort of Clinton-funded thing about Trump and the Russian hookers, and you know, it was just bizarre. So
I was moderating a panel on Monday, and the first question that had nothing to do with my panel, but the former NTIA Assistant Secretary Larry Strickling was sitting next to me, and he said, it reads to me like an intern project.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting perspective.
Yeah. I mean, and you see things like that on the internet sometimes, little high school projects, and, you know, where some diligent kid, you know, tries to figure something out, does a, you know, pretty good job, maybe get 75% of it right. But yeah, I don't see it happening. I mean, so what's 5G? Is the next, well, it's the next generation of wireless networks is sort of the easy answer. So that we're currently on something on 4G, also known as LTE. And those are both kind of marketing terms in a sense. And 4G was preceded by 3G, 2G. And when we had 1G, we didn't know it was a G. It was just the cellular network. And so it was different from the regular telephone network. And so what happens is there's a standards committee called 3GPP, third generation something partnership, but now they've produced the fourth and fifth generation standards, so it's just the acronym now. That's a collection of engineers who mostly work for the companies who build wireless networks and who operate them, who meet on a continuing basis and devise enhancements to the standards for wireless networks, for mobile networks in particular. And so they're the folks that their job is to take new technologies that are just emerging from the labs, standardize them, and publish specifications so that multiple vendors can build the equipment and that the equipment from all the different vendors can interoperate with each other, which means that we have a competitive market for the equipment that the carriers buy. And it also means the carriers can interconnect their networks easily. So the 4G network that we have right now is pretty amazing, and its major feature actually was the fact that it took Internet Protocol, which had previously sort of been like a gateway that the mobile network would have to go through to get to the Internet. So it takes Internet Protocol and embeds it deeply inside the design of the mobile network. So it's no longer a gateway, it's sort of a native Internet Protocol network, and therefore an inherent part of the internet rather than a service that just accesses the internet. And it's great, you know, 4G, we can get download speeds up to, in some instances, 80, 100 megabits per second. But there's an increasing demand for a couple of things that 4G doesn't do. And one of them is latency, which is to say the sub millisecond or the sub-second delays that packets have to undergo when they're transmitted over the air and when they're received over the air. It takes a while for the receiver to sort of synchronize when it receives a packet of information on the cellular network. Takes a while for it to synchronize on it, which means that certain activities, you know, they take maybe 50 to 100 milliseconds worth of delay, which is so a 20th to a 10th of a second. And one of their design goals for 5G is to get that down as low as possible, probably to the, they're saying below 10 milliseconds, but that's going to be hard to do because so much of it depends on distance. So the speed, you know, light speed, it can't go faster than light speed, and light speed is, you know, is a constant. And it also, we want higher download speeds and higher upload speeds. And that means there's some fancy radio technology that lets us squeeze more efficiency out of existing spectrum. But the big deal is, and it kind of follows the logic of Wi-Fi, where if you want to increase your speeds, what you do is you grab a larger chunk of spectrum. And the only available spectrum to be used for cellular networks that we're not currently using is this sort of mid-band spectrum in the 3.5 to say 3.5 to 4.5 gigahertz. That's the spectrum that the FCC has in mind for the sort of citizens broadband radio service, CBRS. And that was actually mentioned in this White House memo. So that was like the only legitimate part of it.
they got mid-band right. Okay.
Yeah, they got the mid-band right. That's important. And also there's this millimeter wave that's much higher frequencies that heretofore we haven't been able to use because we didn't have chips that could do anything with it that didn't consume vast amounts of power. But now it's a practical add-on that I think will be especially useful for providing fixed wireless services. So like a third broadband pipe or fourth broadband pipe into your home that uses wireless instead of a coaxial cable or fiber optic or DSL. So it's just the next evolution. So it's more, better, faster.
So when you talk about things like telehealth or autonomous cars or smart city applications, it sounds like that what really needs 5G is the machine-to-machine more so than humans who may not notice that fraction of a second latency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, the human ear's tolerance for latency when we're making phone calls is around, you know, 100 to 200 milliseconds. So anything below that is really gravy. But yeah, there are certain, you know, very precise calculations that need to be made on a more finely grained time scale than that. And especially if you're collecting a lot of samples from a sensor on a condition that's changing rapidly, the faster you can collect the samples, the sooner you can make sense out of the trend line and take an action. So yeah, this should be important for driverless cars and for... There are some fairly obscure security applications, but the folks who are pushing for the low latency have a whole host of applications in mind that would be enabled by lower latencies.
So the Axios article that leaked the 5G memo talked about the nationalization as if security would have been the end game. And it sounds like what you're saying is security wouldn't be really that much different if it was paid for and the pipe was laid by the national government versus the current private investment of the telecommunications companies.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly the case that the internet has a security problem, right? I mean, it's just sort of a constant thing with identity theft and botnets and... The internet's not a secure system. I mean, it tries to be, and it sort of is sort of secure most of the time. Some applications are really pretty darn secure, like banking. But in order for the internet to be secure, that we have to do, you have these really cumbersome authentication processes that, you know, two-factor authentication and you know, it can get pretty annoying having to jump through a whole bunch of hoops just to look at a website. But a government takeover of the or any kind of any kind of redesign of the, well, the what the cellular network is layer two. So in the seven layer protocol model, so it's the data link layer. Internet is the network layer, and then the end-to-end layer. Security is an end-to-end problem. And so changing how we get bits from, you know, from point A to point B doesn't really have the ability to impact, you know, the security in a very substantial way. And so I think actually to get, to secure the internet, it may be useful to have some security features built into layer two that are not already there, or to have some security features built into the wireless network that are not already there, or into the fiber optic networks. It's fundamentally, you know, the rudder that steers that is end to end. So we need a new version of TCP that has security embedded in it, and so that it authenticates every connection it makes before it makes a virtual connection. And it could, you know, like I said, it could get some help from the routing layer. It could get some help from the data link layer, but it is fundamentally an end-to-end problem. So I think the argument that a government-controlled network is more secure than commercially controlled networks is a red herring. That maybe the intern threw that out because it's sort of a justification for a massive and quite destructive change in the financing and engineering of mobile networks.
Interesting. Well, Commissioner Carr just had a speech actually this morning in Brussels where he talked about really three key things they're focusing on at the FCC. And one of them is $24 billion investment that could incentivize removing the regulatory barriers to deployment. That's obviously $24 billion in private investment. State of the Union was last night. This was not something that the president brought up in his idea of increasing money for infrastructure. So it looks like we're back to having, you know, private entities afford to do this, but there's a lot of incentive for them to do this as we deploy and upgrade and maintain, you know, kind of these networks of the future. What else do we need to be doing? You mentioned the mix of spectrum bands, the mid band, the millimeter wave band. I know that you work on, can you tell me what BDAC stands for?
Broadband Deployment Advisory Committee.
Okay. What have you guys been focusing on? I know there's been a lot of activity in that area in the last couple months.
Well, recently, when a lot of it's been political. People making statements by joining or leaving the committee, and it hasn't really been very helpful. The main focus there is just streamlining the process for building 5G depends on these small cells that are, you can imagine something about the size of a book, an encyclopedia book or smaller.
And that's the size of the small cell you're saying?
Yeah, that's a small cell. And so the permitting process to get approval from the city before you can attach something like that to a light pole or to a traffic light is right now just as cumbersome as the permitting process for erecting a 50-foot tower. And it needs to be simplified. And of course, the prices that the cities charge, the lease rates for using their street furniture, their street lights, needs to be less, obviously, than they would be for a humongous tower that serves a 5-mile radius.
But so the municipal fees are different depending on the jurisdiction?
Yeah, the cities get to charge their own rates. And the FCC obviously has no authority to dictate rates for pole attachments. So those are determined either by the cities or in some cases by state law. And there's been a movement across the country for state legislatures to create uniform statewide regulations on the permitting and the fees for the installation of small cells. And some of the cities are fighting back on that because it's sort of a jurisdictional, who's got the power to make that decision. And that sort of thing is going on. And some, like in California, the legislature passed a bill that would create a statewide standard for small cell construction, but the governor vetoed it.
Ah. Because that would seem to, the symmetry there would make sense for how many different entities are looking to help participate in this evolution of 5G.
Yeah, I mean, the Internet Committee in the House subcommittee had a hearing about this earlier this week. And one of the witnesses pointed out that it takes like maybe an hour to install a small cell, but it can take you, you know, weeks or even months to get the permission to install it. And so it's completely, you know, out of whack. We've got all these regulations that were based on a different generation of technology.
So the idea of having the private sector drive standard setting processes, is that something you've been trying to do in the BDAC, or is it just a collection? You guys are collecting opinions.
Well, we're collecting information right now about fees and rates. I think that actually helps an awful lot when you find out how variable the fees can be for doing the same thing in different cities when it's not fundamentally a different problem. So I think there's a lot of transparency that comes out of that. And so we can actually identify, you know, cities that are being especially obstreperous to deployment of new networks. And they, you know, they have reasons for it. I mean, sometimes there are policy programs that they want to fund with fees from the network construction. But, you know, those policy questions, I mean, they obviously need to be resolved. I'm not personally very concerned about that. I'm more just about what do we have to do to get this technology rolled out? And then I think the whatever policy issues, you know, the cities and states have, they're free to deal with that on their own. The idea that what BDAC is doing is creating model codes for states and cities. And the FCC doesn't have the authority to force anyone to conform to these model codes. They're essentially suggestions that are based on best practices that we discover from looking at codes that are currently in place in different jurisdictions across the country and sharing those with people with municipalities that may not have had the time to do that research.
So we've heard a couple of the carriers say they're going to be launching 5G trials this year. Do you have a crystal ball into where you think we're going to see these trials?
Well, there seem to be generally trials of maybe three different kinds. There are some companies that are betting on 5G as just a general improvement to mobile networks in general. So it's like, you know, faster and more available mobile networks that where we really don't experience network congestion as often as we do today. And then there are other companies that see it as a way to get into the residential broadband market. So Verizon in particular is running some trials in Sacramento, California, and a dozen other cities where they want to see if they build a fixed wireless alternative to cable and DSL, will they be able to sell it? And then there's some, theoretically they can offer download speeds up to 1 gigabit per second. So it should be competitive. You know, but question is, you know, what the take rate's going to be. Because that's the thing that surprised Verizon when they built their Fios network. They I think, imagined that if they deployed a fiber optic network that everybody would basically ditch cable and jump to their network. And they obviously have attracted an awful lot of customers, but it wasn't, the take-up rate wasn't as fast or didn't reach as high a level as they had planned it, which is, you know, it's a troublesome thing from the financial standpoint.
Well, Fios is great, but it's expensive. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, and consumers, I mean, for the most part, we're still not in the business of just buying the broadband as a standalone item. For most people, triple play is, you know, it's still the product is a bundle of internet, telephone, and television. And the smaller carriers, you know, they had a problem with the video part of it. So, you know, Comcast has really good licenses with all the producers of content, and that was a struggle for Verizon. And I think for AT&T, it was part of the reason for the purchase of DirecTV is that they got, you know, they got better deals on the content.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, and I've noticed here in DC, we're seeing more and more advertising for Comcast Xfinity Wireless. So everybody's getting into everyone else's business.
Yeah, everybody's in everybody else's business. Yeah, they're pushing that. They're not pushing it as much in Denver, but it's available.
What is the range on that? I mean, I imagine you stay within wherever their scope is. I just assume it's sort of an urban product, but I could be wrong about that.
I think it. You could be right about that. For the most part, it seems to, it's a hybrid of Wi-Fi and Verizon's mobile network as a fallback when Wi-Fi of sufficient quality is not available.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, so
yeah, and it's clearly, I think, the some of these stovepipes between these different communications companies. I mean, they're all just sort of coming apart, right? So they're becoming, multi-tiered, multi-faceted value propositions that have, at some level, do everything from content to broadband to wireless. So more power to them.
Well, 2018 could end up being a really interesting year on just how fast information can get to you.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and I was going to say there were three different kinds of projects. The third type is the narrowband machine-to-machine Internet of Things stuff. There are an awful lot of IoT devices that are sensors that have really small volumes of information they need to transmit. So it's just like basically is a switch on or off. And so the carriers are building customized service offerings that do that, that carry this sort of low, narrow bandwidth information all over the place very cheaply.
That's just for little snippets of information that don't need to be always on. They're not looking to broadcast a lot of data.
Right.
You mentioned there was a hearing this past week, and we're getting back into 2018. It's already an exciting year here in Washington. I know that you wrote a blog back at the very end of 2017 about a Blackburn proposal, and that she's looking at proposing a ban on blocking and throttling, which was part of the restoring internet freedom dialogue that we've been having, but she doesn't accept paid prioritization. I was wondering why that one particular issue was standing out.
Well, unlike arbitrary blocking and throttling of websites, paid prioritization is a feature that can be beneficial in many contexts. And it's also very poorly defined and very poorly understood by the public. So I think most of the people who are demanding the FCC bring back the ban on paid prioritization that was part of the Tom Wheeler FCC's 2015 Open Internet Order see it as something that ensures that websites will all be fast. And so, they talk about dirt roads and slow lanes and it's that sort of thing. It's the fears that some of the smaller small companies and interest groups and startups and the angel investors that support the early stage startups see that as a potential increase in cost, and so they don't want to have it. But it's kind of a question of throwing the baby out with the bathwater, because there are some applications that actually need to have extremely low latency service, and that's one of the reasons that 5G was created, because there's a recognition of the fact that latency is a really important and not sufficiently acknowledged aspect of the service that broadband providers offer. But it's expensive to provide. So it's expensive to ensure that every individual use of the network is going to be very low latency. So latency, it's sort of like no matter how much bandwidth you have, you essentially have a fixed amount of latency that you can distribute. And it's important that the network operator distributes this finite store of latency in the most beneficial manner. And beneficial means simply to the applications that need it. So Netflix really doesn't care what kind of latency it gets, because the way it utilizes the network, it depends on the fact that, it's going to send a big chunk of packets from their server to your home, and they're going to be buffered, and then your playing device is going to play them out of the buffer, not directly off the wire. So the network latency doesn't really matter. The thing that matters is the having the capacity so they can keep the buffer full of packets. But there are, you know, there are other applications. I mean, well, voice over the internet is clearly one example, video conferencing, lots of gaming stuff, holograms, augmented reality, virtual reality. They need low latency. And then there, you know, healthcare like telerobotics, remote surgery that that need low latency. And, you know, they're willing to pay for it because it's kind of a specialized service. And there shouldn't be a ban, you know, on the ability to do that. And that's been dealt with in a kind of a very subtle way in the previous net neutrality orders. There's always been an exception for what in the Jenikowski order was called specialized services, and in the Wheeler order was called non-biased data services, which means non-internet applications that run over the broadband network. And so the question is, given the concern that the has been created over essentially the non-existent practice of charging people more to be in a fast lane and relegating everyone else to slower service, how do you regulate that in a way that permits the applications that would benefit from having the ability to purchase low latency service without degrading the quality of the network for everyone else and essentially putting the ISPs in a position where they can charge extortionate or extortionate rents from applications? I don't think it's nearly as difficult a problem as it's been made out to be, because, you know, so much of the net neutrality debate is more a question of emotion than rather hardcore, you know, engineering facts.
That is so true. I keep wondering, as I've had to explain this to multiple people, why it is that they want to impede current technology with the base of a 1936 drafted legislation, you know, that went into, which created the FCC. Just yeah, so I mean, many it's, people don't you know, understand
it. It's lawyers. I mean, it's the Communications Act has been on the books for so long. There are a lot of lawyers who are trained in it, and they understand all the ins and outs. And you know, if you spent your whole career developing expertise in that area, you don't want to just discard that and have to start over.
Well, I think if we called it the ability to purchase low latency service, similar to getting an easy pass for an HOV lane, there'd be less of an uproar about it.
Yeah, but you know, it's anything to do with internet policy that's the least bit nuanced gets just shouted down in the public dialogue by all the fear mongering.
Yeah, you know, I've tried to understand the emotion, and the only thing that really makes sense to me is the internet has become such an integral part of people's lives that they fear not having it.
Mm-hmm.
And so Things like the Burger King ad make them feel like they're somehow, somebody's going to get ahead of them in line and they're going to miss out.
Mm-hmm.
I don't quite understand why they feel that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think they're maybe in the back of people's minds, there's the idea that there's something about the internet that's too good to be true.
Oh, interesting.
You know, when we first got broadband, I think mostly what people were doing with it was pirating video content and pirating songs. I mean, it was running Napster and downloading videos that weren't really licensed. And so that was a legitimate feeling. You said, you know, this is not going to continue forever. They're not going to just let me download all their movies without paying for it. And sure enough, you know, it's a lot harder to get pirated content today than it used to be. But, you know, there is that sentiment. And
it's not a bad thing.
Yeah. But it just kind of, it blows my mind that the idea that ISPs are in a position to speed up and slow down websites, well, you know, it's sort of theoretically, hypothetically true that they could do that. The ISPs are not a significant factor in the speed that websites take to load today. And so there are limits actually to the power of an ISP. It's like the idea that an ISP could speed up a slow website is like, well, take package delivery networks. So FedEx has partnerships with the United States Postal Service where FedEx transports packages across the country or across the world, and then they turn them over to the Postal Service for delivery, you know, to the consumer's home. So the Postal Service cannot deliver packages to our homes any faster than FedEx delivers the packages to them, right?
Right.
I mean, the best they can do is not slow it down, you know, excessively. So if they, you know, if they get it by, you know, midnight, they should deliver it, you know, the next day. And this is a situation actually that ISPs are in with slow websites, is that the ISP can't deliver the data to us any faster than the website delivers it to the ISP. And in the case of most of the slow websites, they're just not getting it very fast. And they're delivering it. I've studied this stuff, and according to the FCC's data, the ISPs are getting the content from the websites at about 12 to 15 megabits per second. And so regardless of how hard they work to get it to us faster, they can't get it to us any faster than 12 to 15 megabits per second. And, you know, they're not slowing the stuff down. They're actually, the download pipes into our homes on average are about 6 times faster than the average website. So it's a question that's really under the control of the website creator for the most part. So it's like, you know, what content delivery network do you use to get your website to consumers, and how much performance are you buying from your content delivery network? So it's really, you know, website performance is a question of content delivery networks and the prices they charge and the willingness of website operators to pay for performance. So that's who you pay. You don't pay the ISP. They're just sort of they're the last one that has the packets, and so they get the blame, but it's fundamentally not up to them.
Well, I've read your study on this, and I thought it was really interesting that depending on what the reason for the website is, tends to be why it sometimes gets a little jinky. Mm-hmm. So if you're on a news website, who is one of the main reasons why they're aggregating news is to get ad revenue, mm-hmm. but there are so many different things that are trying to load on that page that it goes beyond that 3-second level of patience.
Yeah. Yeah. The LA Times in particular was one that I found that, where their editorial page, which I guess doesn't get read by a lot of people, had as many as 125
links to it.
References to external sites. So they had images and ads and tracking code that came from 125 different sources.
So do they prefetch for that? I mean, do they just like have it? I mean, I guess the question of the content delivery network is how much of that gets prefetched, so it's kind of ready to go, versus you're changing your mind and you're clicking on things. And so much of the internet's becoming predictable behavior, we're still not completely predictable in what we're doing.
Well, I mean, the problem is the LA Times, they use some content, Akamai or some other content delivery network. But those ads come, like they have the tracking code from Google and Facebook, and those don't come from Akamai. They come from Google and Facebook. And they have their other, some of these smaller ad networks, blanking on the names right now, but they, like Criteo, that come from their own infrastructure. So, and they're apparently pretty slow. And yeah, and the Google stuff, a lot of those ads are auctioned off in real time. So you can't really prefetch it because you don't know who's won the auction. And you can't run the auction until you know who the reader is.
That's a lot of information going across the screen in less than 3 seconds.
Yeah, and very little of it did you even see.
Pretty
and
amazing.
So, yeah, their page, I mean, their editorial, and it just sort of continues to load. It gets the above the fold, I think their above the fold time was around 5 or 6 seconds. But they continue to load the invisible parts of the page, you know, for 30 seconds or longer after you start reading.
And that's when it feels like the website kind of blinks and it's just repopulating, yeah.
Yeah, the images move around. It gets
right. All... Where the
but, you know, the but be... the e-commerce sites are much faster. I mean, Amazon's ultra fast. Well, but Amazon built its own infrastructure. I mean, they have really they kind of have the best CDN going.
Different objective. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, getting back to, we were just talking about legislation. Chairman Walden spoke to the State of the Net on Monday and mentioned that he had 20 pieces of legislation that were looking at different parts of the digital economy that he's expecting to have hearings on pretty soon. Some of them will help cut red tape, encourage innovation. Some of them go towards public safety. He did mention the one that you referenced where they're going to be looking at paid prioritization. I guess the question is, do you think we're going to be looking at a bigger bill similar to the Thune-Walden proposal we've had in the past where we actually take on these key issues that the FCC keeps bouncing back and forth on and just codify all this these ideas into law? What do you think?
Yeah, the amazing thing about that is that Congress has got no shortage of good ideas about how to improve internet and internet access for everybody. They just had a hearing on closing the digital divide that had 25 potential bills behind it. Something like 17 from Republicans and the rest from Democrats. So they're both, you know, both parties are really coming up with, you know, lots of ideas, some of them good, some of them maybe not so good. And I think they're going to probably consolidate into, you know, some number, like maybe could be discrete legislation on closing the digital divide, another piece of legislation on net neutrality. I don't know how many bills it's going to amount to, but there must be close to 100 bills that have been written that are pending in Congress that relate to the internet right now.
Well, it's good to know that members are thinking about it. Let's hope that they're all going towards the positive outcome, do no harm.
Yeah, I don't know. Might have been better back in the days when nobody really cared.
I used to remind a lot of my colleagues about that in the mid-2000s. If people weren't paying attention, that was not necessarily a bad thing.
Yeah. But, I mean, I think we do need to clarify this, the scope of the responsibilities the FCC has regarding the internet and what responsibilities fall on NTIA and FTC and the other agencies. So it would be helpful to get a little bit of coherence and to get us out of this mode where, you know, every FCC chairman feels free to revise the regulatory status of the internet, because, I mean, let's face it, you know, this is a problem for Congress to ultimately solve. Most countries that have enacted net neutrality laws have done it through their parliamentary process. The idea of taking an old telephone era regulation and refilling it with internet stuff is just, it really doesn't make any sense. It's not the way that you should approach this. It's a completely different set of issues, and we need a fresh approach.
Yeah, I think it stifles innovation, and the one thing that you've, going back to the beginning of this conversation about 5G, it's going to take a lot of money to put that in place, but the exponential on it's pretty amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, a lot of these investments are on a 10 to 20 year timeline, so having some policy certainty is, I think, is extremely helpful.
Well, I think hopefully that and a lot of regulatory reform on issues that we made during the analog years, and we don't necessarily need them in our digital world.
Now, how about if we just had a cap on regulations? So the number of regulations can't exceed a certain threshold.
I kind of like the idea that they would just expire unless somebody went out of their way to put them back into place.
Yeah, that can be, that's a double-edged sword, because sometimes the regulations enable you to do something, and if we expire regulations in say 5 years and we sunset them all, then you've created massive uncertainty about
it. We forgot to put speed limits back in, and some people know that and some don't.
Yeah. Yeah, maybe we could do it like an unlimited wireless broadband plan where it's unlimited, but after a certain threshold,
it's limited.
You get slowed down. Your regulations have to be less powerful. But yeah, I mean, I think we have enough regulations on the books. We just don't have the right ones.
Well, thanks, Richard. I think all this information on being 5G ready was really interesting, even if it isn't going to be a national plan designed by an intern.
Well, we can always hope, can't we?
We can.
There's a new crop of interns every year.
Every semester.
Yeah. Okay, folks. So, this wraps it up, this edition of the High Tech Forum podcast. We're always happy to get reviews on iTunes and comments on the blog about the post, and especially suggestions about topics and speakers for upcoming editions of the podcast. We try to do these about every couple of weeks. Doesn't always happen. Sometimes it's a bit more frequent, though. So tune back in and for the next edition of High Tech Forum Podcast.